This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke, Wednesday, the 1st of March, and parts of the internet took a digital snow day yesterday. You could think of it like that. That's what some people call the Amazon Web Services crash that happened in the middle of a workday. You could call it a cloud crash, and some people have. It basically meant all kinds of places all around the internet slowed way down or just stopped working. Here to walk you through yesterday's cloud crash is Todd Bishop, co-founder of the Seattle tech news site GeekWire.
Hi, Bill.
How come the cloud went down?
Well, Amazon Web Services had some kind of problem in its Northern Virginia data centers. They aren't saying exactly what happened. If you're wondering what the heck we're talking about, AWS.
Yeah, what's the cloud?
Yeah, exactly.
What's Amazon Web Services?
So back in the olden days, companies ran their own computer servers. So when you called up a web page, theoretically, it went to the computer server of the company that was running that site in some form. These days, it's all in what's called the public cloud. So in other words, Amazon, Microsoft, Google, they host the data. They serve it up on behalf of the companies that are actually providing the websites. So some kind of error
And the
happened.
Servers are not in South Lake Union. They're all over the place.
Absolutely. All over the world, they have regions. And one of the key regions is in Northern Virginia. And there's a service that Amazon runs called the Simple Storage Service. They call it S3 in the biz. And essentially, that is what went down for what, as of now, are unexplained reasons.
And how did this most affect the average user?
So sites including Expedia, Slack, Medium, the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission website, all were impacted by this. So they either went down or and were inaccessible, or they had images that were not able to be served because of it. At GeekWire, we had problems with our own image library internally. We were having a hard time getting photos into posts because we use Amazon S3. And this really underscores just how dominant Amazon Web Services is in the world of cloud computing. They are the leader far and away. And so when they go down, so does a large chunk of the internet.
Yeah, Amazon has, I've read, almost half the cloud market by revenue. Microsoft has about 15%.
That's right. And then Google is in there as well. And then you have some other companies like IBM and Cisco and others playing a bit of catch up at this point. But this is a $12 billion annual business for Amazon. So this is not small change when something like this goes down.
It's inconvenient, Todd. Is this a grave matter?
It was not grave. I don't think there were any public safety concerns, for example, as a result of this. That said, it really revealed the fact that a lot of these sites don't have redundancy. And what that means in this context is you want to set up your site in Northern Virginia, in California. As you said, Amazon has different regions. And so the idea is if you can get different backups in all of those regions or multiple regions, your chances of being impacted by this are less because you can switch over to another region and serve it up from a different Amazon data center. A lot of companies don't do that, as we learned yesterday.
And is that just something companies ought to fix, or is this some concern that the more traffic there is, is the cloud too dependent on Amazon? Are there looming problems I should worry about?
Yeah, a couple things here. First off, it speaks to the fact that Amazon may want to come up with some kind of automated solution for this. In other words, it's leaving a lot of this up to its own customers to figure out how to configure and set things up. One thing that we may see come out of this is Amazon having a more prescriptive path for companies to set up these kinds of things. The other thing is it actually gives a little bit of momentum to Microsoft and Google. In other words, if companies can create redundancy not only with Amazon Web Services in different regions, but also with multiple cloud providers, that then gives them even more backup. And so that'll basically help to prevent these things in the future.
Was this Amazon hiccup just like a tiny earthquake in that it happens all the time, but usually we don't feel it?
This was a big earthquake. So there are small outages all over the place. One of my favorite sites on the internet is downdetector.com. And the ironic thing was downdetector.com went down yesterday.
It was down.
Yes. So, but to your point, there are small little tremors of outages that happen all the time. You know, sometimes you might not be able to get into Netflix or other things like that on a very short-term basis. in this case, this was one of the worst that we've seen in terms of the overall impact on sites around the web.
I heard some analysts saying this is just a reminder of how reliable the cloud actually normally is. Look at it that way.
I guess that's looking on the bright side. That is true. You know, the fact that this keeps happening, this has happened over the years. It's not the first widespread AWS outage that we've seen. It speaks to the fact that actually, you know, it's not always reliable. It might be, you know, the five nines or whatever they say, you know, 99.999% reliable. But, you know, that 1/1000th of a time that it's not up is very painful for a lot of sites.
See, you can look at the cloud in a sunny way or a cloudy way.
Yeah, absolutely. It just depends on how thin that silver lining is.
Right, right. Todd Bishop, co-founder of a Seattle tech news site, GeekWire. Todd, good to talk with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
It's KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. We are waiting to talk to Republican Congressman Dave Reichert of the 8th District about last night's presidential speech to Congress. His office tells us he's busy right now taking a vote. And that is his job. So that's fair. We hope to get him on in a few minutes. Stay tuned. Every new parent has got to figure out how to handle midnight feedings and nap schedules and keeping up with all that extra laundry. But for parents of kids of color in a mostly white city, there are other struggles. Reporter Ann Dornfeld of KUOW's Race and Equity team visited a support group for families of color with newborns.
Support groups for new parents are popular in Seattle. Parents swap tips about when to introduce the bottle and empathize about new family dynamics. But the mothers gathered in this light-filled Beacon Hill living room have a different mission.
When we talk about race within our groups, we really center people's identities, who we come from, where we come from, our ancestry, and also in the context and construct of what race is in the United States.
Facilitator Selena Velasco is the program director for Families of Color Seattle. The organization brings families together to celebrate the beauty and challenges of raising kids of color in a predominantly white city and in a society where whiteness is prized. Carly Feria is holding her six-week-old daughter, Kazuri, who's part Filipina, part Black.
With this political climate, there's a lot of unknowns, and bringing a young brown person into this world is a little scary, but also there's promise of what change can she make.
Inoka Harat nods. Her 12-week-old son, Ozan, is Sri Lankan and Turkish.
My parents were immigrants when they came here, and I think a lot of the ways that they survived racism was to just keep their head down and keep working. You know, I feel like those were a lot of the messages that I learned from them. And I feel like, actually, I want my kids to be loud and take up space, and I want us to show our Buddhism and our Sri Lankanness as much as possible, you know? And I was like, I'm not back at work yet, but I was like, when I go back to work, I'm going to start wearing my kurtas again, and in a way that I haven't in years.
The moms discuss the tension between wanting their kids to be proud and outspoken about their race and ethnicity, as well as circumspect in certain scenarios. Amy Pock, the executive director of Families of Color Seattle, has 5-year-old and 7-year-old sons who are part Korean, part Japanese. She says a friend of her older son recently mentioned that he takes Taekwondo lessons.
And I said, oh, is your master Korean? And he said, oh, he's white. Of course he's white.
Pak says she pointed out to the boy that since Taekwondo is from Korea, masters are actually often Korean.
And right away my son said to him, that's racist. Right away I was like, oh, kind of worried if Jayu's in white spaces and he's saying this to white kids who don't really know what whiteness is, or are they taught that? And kind of worrying, like, Jayu, I don't necessarily want you to call out racism when you're the only kid of color. But I was so proud of him to be able to identify, like, that was an assumption where whiteness was a norm, and Jayu could see that.
Pak founded Families of Color Seattle 8 years ago. It was originally just a potluck for families around the city. It's now a nonprofit offering everything from hip-hop dance classes for kids to groups for transracial adoptive parents. Hundreds of families take part in its programs and events.
The amazing affinity that people have to connect with other families of color has been really fascinating, and such an honor to support other families connecting to each other. And it's growing. It's more becoming the Northwest, like Snohomish to Tacoma
to the east side.
Carly Feria says she found a lot of groups she could do with her baby, but none that dealt with the experience of raising a child of color.
And, you know, if you look on their websites, it's predominantly white children and their families. And just even acknowledging that the experience is different, I think, is huge with this group.
In Beacon Hill, I'm Ann Dornfeld, KUOW News.
And we're going to hear more about parenting tomorrow. We'll talk with a University of Washington researcher who studies how fathers interact with their kids. It's KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. I have a heavy question for you now. What should you do if you think somebody you love might kill themselves? My next two guests have some experience with that, and so do I. In high school, Galen Emery struggled with his parents' divorce and with being bullied at school. When his older brother, Arthur, came home from college for a visit, Arthur found a suicide note that Galen had left on his computer. They got together with me to talk about what happened after that.
And I actually don't remember if it was on his desktop or if I actually did an active search through his files, but I knew that he wasn't doing well and I thought I should investigate a little further. And I found a suicide note. And I mean, it was jarring. It was overwhelming. It was terrifying. I didn't know if it was an exercise thought process where he was just trying to get his feelings out or if I was on a ticking clock. So it was immediately very difficult to deal with. But I knew that having the opportunity to have found it, that there was an opportunity there to have a positive impact. And that's really what I tried to focus on.
Galen, what was going on with that suicide note?
Yeah, so he did an active search. Let's be very clear.
You're very clear on what happened.
Yeah. There wouldn't have been anything on my desktop. It would have been hidden to some fashion or another, knowing that he used my computer upon occasion. And yeah, right, there's a lot of hurt, a lot of pain, really depressed. And I'd written a number of really kind of depressing and dark poetry, right, just in general. I don't recall ever penning a specific, suicide note, right, a note that said very clearly that I was going to take my own life or do things like that. But I had a lot of that type of material, right? A lot of that stuff had been written. Some of it is a way to deal with the pain and anguish, but definitely around that time, getting to a point of where we're having legitimate thoughts of how would I commit suicide, right? What are the ways in which to do that? So that's really where I was at the time.
Arthur, what was going through your head as you're reading this?
When you encounter a situation like that, especially with somebody you love as closely as your brother, it's dumbfounding, to be quite honest. You're not given an emotional vocabulary to deal with something of this level when you grow up, especially as a man. You don't get the opportunity to develop yourself emotionally to the point where you can say, oh my gosh, I understand that he's hurting this badly. I know what to do. And so you're lost. I mean, you're immediately heartbroken. You're sick to your stomach. You're scared. You're worried. You feel guilty. You feel shameful because you feel that maybe I should have been there more. I'm off at college having a great time and living the life, and my little brother's down here writing, dark suicide poetry. It's unbelievably hurtful for yourself to feel like you've sort of missed this opportunity to be there for them. But suicide is such a taboo subject. Even mental health is a taboo subject. And I think what we miss is that we have this invisible barrier to dialogue around it. And because we have this invisible barrier, you never grow up with any sort of understanding of what to do if you run into a situation like this. You barely know what to do if you have, a sibling who got their heart broken by a boyfriend or girlfriend, right? Let alone somebody who's so emotionally depressed and distressed that they feel that they might want to take their own life.
Well, what did you do next?
So the first thing I did was tried to process it, tried to figure out what was going on. I didn't confront my little brother. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to say. I was worried that I would make things worse. I was worried that I would have a negative impact. What I did instead was I called up our older brother, Brett, and I said, hey, I just found this note on Galen's computer. Well, what should I do? And he had no ability to understand or deal with it either. But what he did say was, honestly, I don't know what to do. You should find a child psychologist and see what they say. With his financial support, I went to a child psychologist in Bellingham, and I sat down with him and I said, what do I do? He said, your job is not to be the psychologist. Your job is not to solve his problems. You can't. Don't put that as an expectation. Your job is to speak to him directly and tell him you love him and tell him you care about him and tell him that you found the note. Be honest about it and, take it on the chin. He's going to be mad that you looked through his stuff, but be honest and let him know and tell him that you care and that you're there to support him and help him out in any way that you can. So he was very clear. He made it very simple, which I thought was really helpful.
And Galen, what's your memory of what Arthur, how Arthur had this, you know, started this conversation?
Yeah, so I mean, I can't recall a lot of detail about it, right? I very clearly remember having the conversation, but the details of it are lost. And I'm sure a lot of it's just because of the emotion. I know that I was very angry. I mean, I felt my privacy had been violated, right? My stuff had been gone through. Also, amount of relief and you know, the fact that somebody now knows about it, right? There's an exposure to it. One of the problems that I was experiencing at the time is that I didn't feel anybody was paying attention to me, right? There's a certain amount of, does anybody care about who I am and what I have to offer? And so that was a very clear moment that was helpful in that regard. That was probably the beginning of my journey towards actual help.
Well, I've heard that a good idea is to ask someone directly, are you thinking of killing yourself? Do you guys remember, did you ask that?
I think he asked that question, yeah. There's a series of questions, right? It's like, are you thinking of killing yourself? Do you have plans to kill yourself, right? At that point, I would have definitely been in the, are you thinking about it, right? But do you have plans to? Absolutely not, right? That wasn't there at that point in time. And so, yeah, those are super key critical things because they forced me to answer straight up, right? You have to give an answer to that question. There's no skirting it. There's no dodging it. There's no changing the subject.
You're not pretending that doesn't exist.
Right, exactly. It's a very direct, very clear, hey, what's the state? How bad is it for you, right? It's not a question of, is it bad, right? It's a question of how bad, where are we at? What do we need to know about so that we can make it better and help out.
So I realize this is such an oversimplifying question, but what did it mean to you to have your big brother, after telling you he snooped, to say, here's where it came from,
yeah.
Are you thinking of killing yourself, and I love you?
It's huge. I mean, it's one of the things that I think was a really key focus of my depression and my suicidal thoughts is this belief that nobody loves you. And I think that for me, at least, to get to the point of considering suicide, you have to convince yourself that nobody's going to miss you when you're gone, right? I think that's a huge piece of the act itself. And to have someone step up and say, hey, look, this thing's really hard for me. I know you're going to be angry with me as a result of my actions, but I did my actions out of the best intent and out of the best heart because I love you and I care about you. That's super powerful. You can't walk away from that. You can't dismiss that kind of thing because you know that if he didn't love you, he wouldn't have done it, right? Even if he had seen it, but somehow I was like, you know what? I don't care enough. He's not that important. He could have walked away, right? He has those options available to him. But by confronting me, like all that goes out the window. You can't ignore that piece of it anymore.
I was in a situation kind of like yours. I knew my 4 years older brother was struggling and I invited him to lunch. And I, you know, first thing, right? How you doing? And then what's the answer? Oh, not bad, you know? And then we got a little deeper, but he said that he was going to go to a VA counselor. And, you know, that's of course what I wanted to hear. And I think I picked up on I heard all the reassurance that I wanted to hear, and I didn't know what else to do. And I told my siblings, hey, he sounded pretty good. And my brother killed himself like 2 days later. Mm-hmm. And it's a little hard. I'm really happy that you're here, Galen. And at the same time, it's a little extra hard, and maybe some of our listeners can relate, to hear a story of how an intervention, you know, that person doesn't have to die.
For me, it's been quite a journey because, you know, beyond even the situation that my little brother and I have gone through, I had a friend who I knew in college, Blake King. Loved him to death. He, you know, lit up a room, great smile, amazing laugh, was so sensitive and caring. He ended up going to Iraq as a contractor and ended up coming back, and he was just a sort of a different person. And I, you know, we kept emailing and everything, and he stopped responding to emails. I just figured, you know, we'd grown apart. I found out this past August that he had passed away through suicide, that he had shot himself, and that he had done it a few months after we had sort of fallen out of email contact. And I was floored. And I had all the same feelings, I think, Bill, that you did. Even though he wasn't my brother, I still had the what ifs. You know, I mean, what if I had done this? Or what if I had said this? Or what if I had been there for this? What if I had done that? And I wish I could tell your listeners that those will go away, or that there's, you know, that that's something that you will overcome. But I think we will always look back and think we could have done more. We could have done this. We could have done that. And I think that the real key for all of us is sort of breaking down this invisible barrier, so that when things like this happen and you're in that lunch with your brother, we can do the things that organizations like Forefront, the suicide prevention group, show us are effective, which is directly asking, are you thinking of committing suicide? And I think that even, you know, taking your brother to lunch and having that conversation and doing the best with what you had, I think that you and all the listeners who have had similar experiences should reflect on that and say, I was unprepared, and that is an absolute tragedy. But at the same time, I did everything that I knew to do, and there's nothing else I could have done differently. But now our job is to make sure that other people are prepared. Because I got lucky. I got lucky that my older brother had the brilliant idea of talking to a child psychologist. I think that our job now is just to make sure that people are educated and informed so that they know what they can do that does have a direct positive result. Because you're right. I mean, these tragedies, they don't need to happen. And I think that we can help make sure that they don't.
I really appreciate you saying that. That's very compassionate of you and constructive to think of it that way. So thanks. Galen, another oversimplifying question. I don't want to assume that because you're here that life is all roses now. How, you know, but the listener, I think, wants to know, how are you doing?
I'm doing really well. I have an amazing job. I got engaged back in December with an amazing fiance. Planning a wedding is its own challenge. but I have found the things that make me happy and that help out. Depression can be classified by many people many different ways. The thing that I found about my depression in particular is that it's a self-defeating cycle. My depression wants me to not hang out with people, to not see people. And then as a result of not doing that, I get more depressed and I'm less inclined to go see people and things like that.
I would say too, Bill, I mean, ever since I met you at the Forefront Dinner and really thought more deeply about all this, I feel that I've run—
This was a suicide prevention group, and we were both there, and I was speaking.
Yeah. I feel like I've run into this concept that people have, and Galen hit on it, and, you know, I've suffered from depression as well. Our mom had depression all growing up, and so I've felt the effects of it, and there's this feeling you get when you're not feeling right that you don't deserve support, that somehow something about this being a mental issue means you don't get the support that you should get. I mean, you can take the analogous situation. If you're at the gym or you're playing sports and you push yourself too hard, and let's say you sprain your ankle playing basketball, what's the first thing people are going to expect you to do? They'll expect you to go get crutches, go to the doctor. They'll expect you then to be sort of gimpy for a while as you're recovering, and they'll do things for you. They'll gladly grab your water off the table if you forgot to put it close enough, right? I mean, there's no question. If you hurt yourself physically, you're on a path to recovery and you need some extra help. The same is not true if you think about someone who, you know, is going through the death of a child or the death of a loved one or a divorce or veterans who come back or people in the LGBTQ community who are mentally being beaten down. You know, they're pushing themselves outside of their mental comfort zone and they end up hurting themselves. There's nothing in our society that says, great, they should go get some mental crutches. They should go to a mental doctor. And you know what? I'll give them their metaphorical water when they need. It is the opposite. It's this idea that this is your problem to deal with and I'm not here to help you. And I don't know if it's a inner fear that if we go to help someone with their mental issues, we're actually just going to let loose all of our own mental issues.
That's,
you know,
interesting.
And so it becomes this mirror where you can look at someone and say, well, I don't play basketball, so I'm not going to get a sprained ankle. But you can't look at someone and say, I'm never going to lose a loved one or I'm never going to go through a divorce. I mean, it's absolutely possible. And so I don't know which piece of it we need to tackle more. But I think that it all needs to be broken down because this invisible barrier to dialogue, I think, is the biggest obstacle to us making a huge difference here.
I would agree. I think the key there is that without being able to, without having the ability to have that dialogue, you don't get the empathy, right? It's hard to look at someone who's having a hard day and know why. There's also the fear that if I start the conversation with them, I have to become the psychologist. I have to become the doctor in that situation. No, it's as I said, just you have to be there to pass the cup of water, right? Or help them when they fall down, right? Just do the human thing to be kind to other people around you. All those conversations are about is about reminding people that you love them and that they are valued and that there's a reason why we want them around us.
Arthur and Galen, I wish everybody had a brother like you guys. So, you know, thanks for helping bring us into that.
Absolutely. And if I can just say, I mean, if I could leave the listeners with one thing, it would be, I don't have the emotional capacity to be a therapist or to be a psychologist or to help people on a level that those people do. What I do have the capacity to do is simple things to show people that I care about, that I love them. And that really, I think, is your role as a person who is supporting somebody who's going through emotional difficulties.
This is one of the things our father says, we all do the best we can with what we think we have. And one of the things I take from that is that the problems that you're experiencing, they're legitimate. They are real. Don't downplay your own depression. Don't downplay your own seriousness of the struggles you face as an individual. And understand that the people around you want to help you. The people around you love you. They care about you. If you give them that opportunity, they'll help.
Guys, I'm glad you're both here to tell the story. Thank you for this.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you, Bill. Absolute pleasure to be here.
Hey, and one more piece of information, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. If that's all you know, you can start there. 800-273-8255. 800-273-8255. It's KUOW Seattle. Thanks for tuning in today on this first day of March. Our big story today is President Trump giving his first speech to Congress yesterday, and he also made some news that was not in that speech. And here with a reaction is Washington's member of Congress from the 8th District, that is East King and Pierce counties, across the Cascades into eastern Washington, Republican Dave Reichert. Welcome to KUOW.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me on.
I understand you were taking a vote just seconds ago. What would you vote on?
We voted on what's called the Scrub Act. And what that does is it establishes a commission to review existing federal regulations and that hopefully we then can identify those that need to be repealed. Part of the effort here is to reduce costs, government costs, and the other effort is obviously to reduce regulations that might impede small businesses from doing their jobs. We, you know, recognize that there has to be some regulations, obviously, but I think, you know, if you look at our tax code, you might say that our regulations has kind of gone amok, just as the tax code is sort of gone amok. So we're trying to streamline things here and make government a little bit simpler and work for the people rather than work against them.
You know, that reminds me, Congressman, we'll get to a couple other things, but there's a regulation that a lot of Northwesterners are thinking about with President Trump wanting to roll back the Clean Water Rule from the Obama administration, regulating streams and wetlands here. Right. I wonder, do you support that rollback, and do you expect to oppose the president when it comes to government rules protecting our natural environment here in the Northwest?
Well, no, you know, I've been a very strong voice in protecting our environment. In fact, the Alpine Lakes Wilderness area is a result of our hard work in our office and 22,000 acres added to the Alpine Wilderness area as a result of a bill that I authored. And it took 7 years. We didn't give up on that to push that through. Co-sponsor of Wild Sky, a strong voice to save salmon and create clean water in Puget Sound, working with our entire delegation to accomplish that.
And on the Clean Water Rule, have you decided how you'd vote on that?
Yeah, on the Clean Water Rule.
Well, that's an EPA rollback, I guess, but it's a long process.
It is, but here's the problem with, again, this applies to a lot of different things. And when the administration, I don't care if it's Democrat or Republican, my message has been the same. Executive orders is not a way to legislate. Mm-hmm. That includes the current president, President Bush, and President Obama. The people elect Congress to make law and to legislate those issues that are important to American citizens. So some of these rollbacks are a result of trying to legislate through executive order, and then we're going to go back, we'll examine the executive order, and then we'll come up with legislation that we think will protect our environment and also allow businesses and people to prosper in our great country.
Okay, a couple of big issues here. The biggest surprise yesterday was President Trump reportedly told some journalists he's open to letting some undocumented immigrants get legal status. And that is a switch that didn't show up in last night's speech. You've supported that idea. Will enough other Republicans go along with that legal status path?
Yeah, I think there is a growing number of people in the Republican conference that see the value in that. I've been part of the value of having me in Congress is that, you know, having that voice to be able to sit down as we're in those long vote series, which is why I sprinted back here to get on the phone. We were in on the floor voting. But it gives us that opportunity to share our ideas and thoughts with other members who may not be quite there yet. But I think it's absolutely critical that we create that pathway. These are people that have come to our country. They have lived here. They've raised their families here. They are United States. You know, they're Americans, and they want to become citizens. And I think we ought to figure out a way to make that happen without compromising our security. Of course, those two together have to be major emphasis as we go forward in immigration. And one of the things I'd like to see when we talk about immigration is separating out the H-1B visa issue and also separating out the immigrant workers, the migrant worker issue, because that's so critical to some of our companies and businesses and ag business in Washington State. The other thing I'll mention is I've been a strong voice, as you know, and I hope our listeners know, in protecting our dreamers in Washington State. And as you may have heard, just a week ago, Jayapal and myself sponsored together the Bridge Act, which is a protection for those kids who came to this country with their families.
Yes, and we talked with Congresswoman Jayapal just this morning. On the topic of local police helping federal immigration agents, you were the sheriff of King County. If an officer does a traffic stop, should they ask someone's immigration status? Where's the line?
Yeah, I think there is a fine line there. I think you really have to, again, you know, law enforcement officers have to have that discretionary power, because sometimes it might be vital information that they may need in order to process whatever, you know, event or call that they happen to be at. If we're at a violent crime scene and we're looking for a suspect and you come across some information that may lead that way, and you also find out during your interrogation or interview of witnesses or interrogation of possible suspects, you find out that there's an immigration issue, you know, your duty is to notify immigration, ICE, and that's the responsibility of law enforcement, is certainly to make sure that laws are enforced. It's not local law enforcement's primary responsibility, but it is a part of their duties to be a part of that legal system and law enforcement system.
Congressman, I'm talking to 8th District Republican Congressman Dave Reichert. You voted to repeal the Affordable Care Act. President Trump promises that its replacement is going to make everybody happy. Here he is.
Everybody's got to be covered. This is an un-Republican thing for me to say, because a lot of times they say, no, the lower 25%, they can't afford private. But
universal health care.
I am going to take care of everybody. I don't care if it costs me votes or not. Everybody's going to be taken care of much better than they're taken care of now.
Who pays for it?
The government's going to pay for it, but we're going to save so much money on the other side. But for the most part, it's going to be a private plan, and people are going to be able to go out and negotiate great plans with lots of different competition, with lots of competitors, with great companies, and they can have their doctors, they can have their plans, they can have everything.
They can have everything. But Congressman, can you tell your constituents they will lose nothing from an Obamacare repeal and replace?
Well, what I never make those kinds of promises. Even back when I was in law enforcement, there were few promises that I made. What I always try to do is to search for common ground in solving problems, and especially in a huge problem like this, we have to find common ground to move forward here, and hopefully we can get to that point. But, I find that in this job especially, it's hard to please everyone. So as we move forward with healthcare reform and tax reform and many of the other problems, immigration is another example. Some people are not going to be happy, and some people are going to be happy. Whatever you do, there's some people who are not entirely pleased with the action that's been taken. That's been my experience in in my professional life.
Congressman, a couple of listener questions. You voted this week with other Republicans not to request President Trump's tax returns. A listener named McKenzie asks, why'd you vote that way? And would you support requiring Trump and all future presidents to share their tax returns?
So first of all, there is no law that requires the president to produce his tax reforms. However, there's been a precedent set. There's a past practice precedent that's been set by some past presidents in producing those tax reforms. And would I like to see Donald Trump present his tax reform? Tax returns. I'm stuck on tax reform.
Mm-hmm.
His tax returns. Yes. However, my vote to not require the chairman to request those records was strictly based on current law. The chairman, first of all, doesn't have that authority. He has authority to ask for tax reforms that are connected to specific investigations within the jurisdiction of the Ways and Means Committee. There is no investigation, including the IRS, in the Ways and Means Committee that pertains specifically to the president's tax records. It'd be like me asking for any American citizen, name anyone. It'd be like the Democrats asking us to ask the chairman to ask for Joe Blow's tax records. The president has the same legal protections as any other citizen across the country in that regard. However, I will say this. There are investigations that are occurring. I think that you probably are aware of. One is in the Judiciary Committee, which is the Bob Goodlatte Committee. Another is in the Intelligence Committee, and another is in the Oversight Committee. So three committees chaired by Republican members, in cooperation with, by the way, the ranking members of each one of those committees, the Democrats. They've all agreed to take on a fair investigation, thorough investigation of Mr. Trump and any of his connections with the Russians that may lead to investigations that could result in a request for his tax records.
Yes, Congressman, I want to ask you about Russia and fighting the Islamic State and a lot more stuff. We're out of time right now, so will you come on again and continue the conversation?
No, absolutely. I'm pleased to do that.
Thank you. Thank you. Republican Congressman Dave Reichert, 8th District. That's East King and Pierce Counties and stretching across into eastern Washington. And you're listening to KUOW Seattle. At your local store, you'll find cleaning products that advertise, "We kill bacteria." If you get sick, your doctor might prescribe you antibiotics. Well, B. Brett Finley says we're doing that wrong, especially when it comes to our kids. Finley is a microbiology professor at the University of British Columbia. In his book, Let Them Eat Dirt, he says our cleanliness obsession threatens our kids' health. And to understand how we got here, you need to go back about a century.
Because that's when they started to figure out that microbes that could cause disease, so infectious diseases. So these were called germs, and they realized if you brought in sewers and got rid of the rats and the mice, and you had clean food, clean water, you brought in antibiotics, and the infection rates plummeted. 100 years ago, 30% of kids less than a year of one would die of infection. Now it's 0.1%. So it worked. It worked really well, and we realized this. So I think what we experience now is really a hangover from that area that we realized we got to keep things clean. So now, in the last 5 years, we suddenly realized that, well, when we swept out all these bad bugs, we get rid of all the bugs, period. And there's this massive cleansing of all microbes. And you think of how we grew up as a species, evolved as a species, we were basically exposed to all these microbes. And so now we realize these kids are not getting these microbes that are needed for them to develop early in life. And stunningly, we now realize these things are basically having a big effect on the Western diseases such as asthma, obesity, diabetes, inflammatory bowel disease, brain issues. And these all have microbial links. And even 5 years ago, we had no idea. So the moral of the story is we cleaned up the world too much, and we got to rethink that because we got rid of the good with the bad, and this is having big consequences.
What good do microbes do?
Oh, they do many good things. They're absolutely critical for the immune system to develop, for example. They're absolutely critical for the brain to develop. You can actually have animals that are basically sterile. We call them germ-free animals, and their brains don't develop normally. They're key for bone and muscle development. They're key for intestinal development. So they actually do have a role, and probably their biggest role is breaking down our food, because most of the food you eat, you don't break them down. Your microbes break it down, and then they feed you.
You've been studying the negative effects of bacteria for 30 years. How was it to begin to look at the positive side?
Yeah, we jokingly say diarrhea is my bread and butter because I work on microbes that cause diarrhea, E. coli and salmonella, and that's what I made my living at. And really, it all went back to a lab retreat we had, and we were discussing, well, what about all those microbes in the gut? Could they possibly do anything? And because everyone knew they were there, but they didn't deal with them. But you realize if a diarrhea-causing bug comes in, it's got to compete with all these things. And so we then came back and started to look at that, and that got us in the door. And really, I think it's been a stunning, basically, revolution of all of biology, how much these microbes are impacting so many different fields. And yeah, it's kind of weird studying the good bugs instead of, I used to think all microbes were enemies because that's what I worked on kind of thing. But now we realize all the good they have and how they influence us is really profound.
Then what is the right balance between protecting ourselves, yeah, our kids, and letting them get those healthy microbes?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. It's balance. So, I mean, you know, despite the title of the book being Let Them Eat Dirt, we're not suggesting shoveling dirt down a poor little infant in its mouth. I mean, there is a balance, but I think we have to rethink how we behave. So I think we have to allow our kids to have normal microbial exposures that we're depriving them of. For example, the simple act of getting a dog, that will decrease your asthma rates by 20% by just having a dog.
I don't want a dog, just to be clear.
Okay, well, don't get a cat because it doesn't have any effect. They live in a corner and they sort of give you the thumb. So
you should get rid of a cat.
I'm not going there. So anyway, yeah, then other things like, you know, how you're born, you know, cesarean section versus vaginal delivery. Ironically, that has a 20% effect on your rate of getting asthma 5 years later, just by the microbes you encounter when you're actually born, because birth is a very messy business, but we actually need those microbes in the woman's vagina to actually start to break down the breast milk. And if you're born by C-section, the microbes are actually more like the mother's skin, and they don't have the capacity to break down breast milk. So biology set it up this way, and I think we're kind of blowing off biology in our, you know, our bubble wrapping these kids, and I think we're starting to see the consequences.
I think we know by now, don't use antibacterial soap, don't use hand sanitizer.
Right.
But when do we wash our hands?
Yeah, first of all, you're right. You use soap and water. You don't need antibacterial. Studies have shown they don't do any different, and you know, the FDA has recently got rid of one of those just because it didn't work. So soap and water, probably before meals, after going to the washroom, for example.
Why, number one or number two? Or both?
Whatever your preference. I mean, you know.
Well, I asked because I'm trying to recalibrate, and we shouldn't maybe wash our hands as much?
Yeah. I mean, you know, in a playground, you know, I was watching her kid in the playground, and pretty much every time the kid, you know, got off a swing or went on to another thing, he ran back, got his hands sanitized, ran back again. No, don't do that. Maybe when the kid comes in for dinner after all that, you know, you wash the hands. I mean, I was growing up, you know, my brother and I had a competition of how big a ring around the bathtub of dirt we could actually make, and the bigger it was, the better the day it was, kind of thing. So I think, you know, you do have to use reason. You know, let them play in a sandbox unless there's cat feces in the sandbox, because cat feces can carry parasites, for example. You know, we jokingly say let them lick the floor in your own house, but probably not the subway, for example. You know, you sort of balance these things, and it is hard to do prescriptive things, but I think we just have to ease off a bit and realize that, you know, the chance of getting an infection these days are way, way less than 100 years ago. You know, it's a balance, and we got to figure out how to recalibrate that balance so these kids actually do get some microbes in their life.
You say you lick the floor in your own house, maybe jokingly, but I mean this because, for example, my wife wants our family to never share a fork or a cup.
Oh.
You know, don't bite your carrot and then dip it back in the hummus. We have
no double dipping.
no double dipping. That's her rule. So,
she can have
what's
all,
right.
A lot of studies have shown that family lives together, shares their microbes. You know, you are going to be microbiologically more similar to your spouse than you will with your twin brother and sister on the other side of the world. We know if you have, we can actually tell looking at kids' feces whether they have a dog in the house and what kind of dog that is. So if you live in the same house, you share your microbes. And, you know, sharing fork or not, your microbes will be the same. So I wouldn't worry about that. I think you do need to think, you know, what is infectious? You know, if you have a very serious cold or something, no, don't share your fork. But under normal circumstances, you're not transmitting disease, share your microbes. It's a good time, good family life, you know?
Did you hear that, honey? You listening? Well, let's talk about that then. You say, you know, well, of course, if you're around someone sick, a lot of parents are nodding, they're ready to believe what you've learned about microbes. Some parents, this is the way they do things, is the hand sanitizer, the antibacterial soap. How do you reach that person?
Yeah, that's hard. I mean, I certainly feel for these parents because they think they're doing their very best thing they can for this kid. And they've been taught that, you know, like you have to keep it clean and the kid will be better. And we all want to do the best for our children. But I think you have to steel up and think, okay, you know, maybe that's not actually the best thing for my kid. I mean, study after study is really showing that I'm just not smoking things. I mean, this really does have an effect. And if you truly care about your kid, I mean, you got to rethink this. And, you know, as much as it's going to feel a bit strange letting them, you know, lick that, you know, thing they picked off the floor, it's actually, you just have to tell yourself it's in the best good for that kid to do that. And, you know, it's going to drive you crazy the first little bit, but then you realize they're fine, they don't get sick, you know, and you'll ease off a bit. And it'll actually make your life easier because you won't have to sterilize all your bottles, and you'll actually get some sleep, and you can chill out a bit and, you know, enjoy your kid more. So work at it. You know, make sure the vaccines are up to date in the child. That's really important for infections. And then go with the ride and let the kid be a kid.
Where should our listeners go for more information? Online is nice.
Yeah, but the problem online is unreviewed. At our book site, letthemeatdirt.com, we actually put a link to a really nice study that lists all the double-blind placebo clinical controlled trials of probiotics. So this is the one that will tell you which probiotics work for which disease, for example. So there's good there. We also tried to put a bunch of other information on, you know, healthy things you can do. And of course, the book, each chapter finishes up with a sort of a do's and don'ts based on the science. You know, some simple things that I learned, like if a kid spits their soother on the ground, you have a choice.
Soother meaning a pacifier?
Yeah. One of the things you stick in the mouth. Sorry, maybe that's Canadian for pacifier. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Anyway, kid spits it on the floor. You've got two choices. You can actually stick it in your own mouth and back in the kid's mouth, or you can run to the bathroom and wash it off. And they actually did a study of a bunch of parents that did these alternate two different ways of doing it. And they found that if you stuck it in your own mouth, the kid actually had less rates of asthma and obesity than if you went and washed it off. So you're giving the kids more of your microbes, which presumably, you know, helps colonize these kids and decrease these diseases later. So there's a bunch of fairly simple things you can do. You know, antibiotics, obviously don't abuse them. Use them only if really needed. They just carpet bomb the microbiota. They kill good and bad equally, so only use them if they're needed. But if they're needed, definitely use them. Try and eat very diversified diets. And, you know, I think the real thing is let kids be kids. I mean, a little kid in action, they are putting everything they possibly can in their mouth. If that was so bad, how come they're doing that? Wouldn't we evolve not to? So there's kind of this thought kicking around that, well, maybe they're sort of sampling their world. They know what world they're in, so they can get used to the microbes. So if they see them later in life, they won't react to them and cause, say, allergic diseases, for example. And it's just part of the natural. I mean, this is how we evolved as a species. You know, think how our ancestors were 1,000 years ago. I mean, kids were living very differently. Yes, they had infectious diseases, but they also had this microbial exposure. And kids these days don't get it.
B. Brett Finley, professor of microbiology, University of British Columbia, and his book is Let Them Eat Dirt. In case you missed the part where we talked about the study of which probiotic to use when, we're tweeting a link to that right now. And if you want to hear more from him, we're tweeting a link to a talk he gave about microbes and health. The video begins with a jazz band playing on stage. Don't get weirded out by that. Finley plays the saxophone in that band. I'm guessing he's chill about cleaning the mouthpiece on that sax. It's KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today. Finally, last night, President Trump told Congress the U.S. should adopt a merit-based immigration system like the one Canada has. Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer, we're going to start copying you now. How does that work?
Well, Bill, we had two shout-outs in the president's speech last night for Canada, one for our immigration system and the other for this international panel on women entrepreneurs that the president and the prime minister put together on their recent summit. So we're doing okay in Trump land.
Mm-hmm.
The immigration one's an interesting thing. Australia has the same system. And look, there's the fine details would have to be sorted out, but essentially we award a point system for immigration, and we also use the immigration system to admit people in jobs and classifications where we need people. There's another wrinkle which probably wouldn't end up in the American system, which is we also have points for people who speak French because those people emigrate to the province of Quebec, which is French-speaking, and where they control their own immigration. But yeah, the general term is accurate. We have what you would call a merit-based immigration system.
Yes, the president did not mention the French exception last night. We're gonna leave that to you.
And we do have refugee programs, and we have, and you and I talked about it last week. We've had refugees showing up on our borders, sneaking into Canada and asking for asylum here because they don't think they're going to get it in the United States. So we've got that. We have family reunification for people who are already here. So there's a whole variety, range of programs. But the basic point that the president made is something that Canada does already, Australia and some other countries do, which is essentially we're pretty choosy about the people we let in. We let people in who tend to fill job classifications or careers that we want. We also have an investor program. If you invest in Canada, you get to come in that way as well.
Mm-hmm. So that's Trump and immigration in Canada. And speaking of our towering president, it is an icon in the sky, says the developer. No, it is a beacon of intolerance, says a Vancouver city councillor, talking about Trump Tower Vancouver that opened yesterday. Is anybody still protesting today?
No, the protesters have gone away. There were a few hundred there yesterday, but peaceful. The RCMP were on site, and they said there were no major problems. Everybody had their say. This is the first Trump building to open anywhere in the world, I think, since he became president. So there's some controversy associated with that.
Yes.
It's the second tallest building in Vancouver. It's a condominium tower, which is pretty much sold out, and the luxury hotel. It's actually the whole thing is owned by a Malaysian developer. The Trump thing is kind of a franchise arrangement. But anyway, it went smoother than people thought, and there was a whole bunch of Trump offspring here, both sons and daughter Tiffany. So fair amount of attention. The media was given a tour of the place. There's an Ivanka Spraw in there, so Trump chocolates. You can get pretty much anything Trump that you want there, I guess, if you're into that kind of a place.
How do Vancouverites seem to like the building's design, the sleek tower, twisting glass?
Designed by the most famous architect in British Columbia history, Arthur Erickson.
Mm-hmm.
Originally designed as a different hotel chain, Ritz-Carlton, I think they went under and the building got taken over and redeveloped. It's an addition to the skyline. I think there's probably fair to say there's a lot of people in Vancouver, including members of the city council, that would like to see the Trump name removed from it, but the building itself is a hit.
One Vancouver city councilor said the Trump brand is about glitz and glamour and, quote, it's not our thing, which I hear people say about Seattle sometimes, but is it true? Is there not a part of Vancouver that's glitzy and glamorous?
Oh, I think we feel a little bit of glitzy and glamorous. We're not all granola, you know, and,
right.
And sandals. It's a diverse city with a lot of diverse viewpoints. It will remain to be seen whether the Trump brand, survives all the controversy associated with Trump. I mean, this is a high-end luxury hotel, and I expect a lot of those people are probably not as anxious about Trump as some of the people that were on the picket line yesterday. I would think most of the people on the picket line yesterday wouldn't be able to afford the Trump Hotel, even if they did like the name of it.
Trump International Hotel and Tower Vancouver, grand opening yesterday, and that's Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer telling you about it. Vaughn, thank you.
Bye-bye, Bill.
That building bears the Trump name, not owned by the Trump family. The family will manage the hotel, and President Trump no longer runs that family company, but he still has a financial stake in it. You're listening to The Record, KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke.